most of the time it was a kind of challenge that was exciting. I think it's because we live on small islands and we go out on the reef and the big waves wash suddenly and, you know, and we're down and struggling to get up again. It was perhaps that background and upbringing that we had this great sense of excitement, you know, and yet it's partly survival.
Florence Johnny Frisbee grew up living far away from the comforts of a traditional population center, surviving on whatever food a small coral atoll and the ocean might provide. The Odyssey of Johnny Frisbee, next on Long Story Short.
Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox is Hawaii's first weekly television program produced and broadcast in high definition.
Aloha mai kakou. I'm Leslie Wilcox. Florence Johnny Frisbee of Honolulu has spent her entire life on an odyssey. Born in Tahiti, Johnny traveled the South Pacific, spending her childhood on small remote Cook Islands like Puka Puka and the virtually uninhabited Suvaru. At age 12, she started documenting her adventures. At 15, she was a published author, the first Pacific Island woman to accomplish that. Her autobiography was Miss Ulysses of Puka Puka. Johnny was born to a native Puka Pukan mother and an American father, Robert Dean Frisbee, who was a writer and South Seas trader.
I understand your dad was from Ohio.
Yeah.
And your mom was from Puka Puka.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Well, he left San Francisco and ended up in Tahiti. He could see the future, what is happening to America, to the United States, to the people, the land and all that. And he wanted to get away from it. He didn't get away to write, the purpose being to write. He wanted something more natural and pure and not so money-oriented. And so he just got on the boat, on the tramp steamer, as they call it those days.
He didn't know anybody?
Yeah. He had read James Norman Hall, and he knew he was in that area.
Mutiny on the Bounty,
yes,
writer.
Yes, okay. Yes. And so he arrived in Tahiti, met James Hall, and they became very close friends. But then he lived there for many years, many, many years, and also could see where Tahiti is becoming a place with a lot of ships and sailors and wanderers, explorers are ending up in the big parties and drinking and all that. And he was disillusioned and wanted something even simpler and quieter and a culture that suits him, whether, you know, it's a dream. And he ended up on Puka Puka.
Can you tell us about Puka Puka? When we talk about Pacific Island neighbors, Puka Puka is far, far from Hawaii. Can you tell us about it and your life there?
Puka Puka, it's a small atoll north of all the Cook Islands. It's the most northern island of the 15 islands. My mother comes from Puka Puka, and her mother before her.
She was much younger than he?
Yes, she was 16, yeah.
And how was that? There was an age difference, a cultural difference, and how did that work out?
That really is not important. You know, age, women don't, you know, sit around thinking about their age and worrying about growing old. That's not in the picture, you know, and it's whether it works, something works, okay? And my father being a white man, and, this is very nice, you know, and he wants our daughter. This is the family in the tribe talking about, you know, what are we going to do, you know. And we don't know him, you know. They don't know anything, didn't know anything about the white man, as they call him. And so it was so foreign to them. So
how many totally white foreign. Men or white
only
people?
Only one, yeah.
On the island?
No. Only him, yeah.
I see.
Yeah, and they come and go. They come on the boat and leave the next day. But he stayed. And so they wonder, what do we do? You know, he wants to marry our daughter. and the 16 age didn't come into the conversation whatsoever. So they all assessed his ability to fish, you know, and ability to paddle, and ability to husk coconut, and the way that he speaks on softly. And they kind of wondered about him because he didn't go to church. He wouldn't go to church, and they thought that might be a problem. But no, the other, you know, the fact that he could do all these other things Puka Puka men do is sufficient to give our daughter to him. And that's how it happened.
All right, so he passed the test, and the marriage was a success.
Yes, very much so.
How many children followed?
Five. The eldest is Charles, and he was taken away from my mother when my father was away when she gave birth to him.
Charles was taken away from your mother?
There's a custom on Puka Puka. The first and second children of the couple is the father's share, and then he gives them away as a gift to his parents or grandparents or brother who may not have, you know, can't have children, his wife cannot have children. And then the third and fourth children are the mother's share, and actually she gives. This is a gift, the ultimate gift to her mother, to her parents and sister or brother. And so when my mother and father moved to Rarotonga, my father had a job offered on another island, copra making copra out of coconut, the coconut meat. So my mother, she was then 17, 18-year-old, was left on Rarotonga in the care of our grand aunt, who did not have any children. So when my mother gave birth, Piki Piki took the baby and said, "This is our share. I'll take this baby." And my mother, coming from that culture, and my father not being there, said, "Yeah, okay, yeah, you take." And so she took the baby and Charles and disappeared into the valley. When my father came back, found he had no firstborn, he was devastated. So he asked the two policemen on the island to please go fetch this woman and bring back his son. And those men, knowing their culture, understanding fully what this natural process was, just kind of walked in the valley, looked around, came back and said, "Oh, can't find her."
So he never saw his son?
No.
Until he was
13. He was 13. We came back in 13 years later.
Well, you're number two. Were you given away?
No, because my father made sure that he was there.
No more culture like that, right? No. So all the other children, two, three, four, stayed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, what was everyday life like when you and your dad and your mom and siblings were there? What did you do during the day? What was family life like?
We were very busy kids. You know, the kids are busy. We played a lot, climbed trees and hide and seek and swim in the lagoons, swim out to the corals. Way out, and then but we had duties too, you know. We had to help the women in the taro patch. Yeah,
well, that's hard work.
Yeah, well, we didn't play it most of the time. But we
in 1937, Johnny Frisbee's mother gave birth to her fifth child. 2 weeks later, she fell ill and her condition worsened. She passed away the following year.
Your mother was so young when she passed away of tuberculosis, 26.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What happened in your family at that time? What were some of the effects?
Well, my father took total control of the family. You know, he became the mother, father. And because my mother had asked him before she died not to separate us, because that is commonly what happens with families. And her parents were very eager to take two of us as their share. And my father said, no, you know, these are my children too, you know, and I don't belong in that. And that was the reason why my father decided that we leave Puka Puka.
What was the thing you missed most about your mother after she was gone?
When I think about her, what I remember of her, I just remember her looking at me, you know, just like looking at me, you know.
She loved you.
Yeah, and that's you know, and so I'm happy when she looks up at me like that and all this love and faint smile. I take a breath and I run away, then disappear for hours and play with my friends, you know. And then I'll think about it and I'll come back and just stand in front of her to get this. Mm-hmm. I miss that.
Johnny Frisbee's father moved the family around the South Pacific to places like Fiji and even settled on Suvaru Atoll in the northern Cook Islands. They lived on tiny Anchorage Island, which had a landmass of less than one-tenth of a square mile. It was there that the motherless family faced a terrible storm.
This was Suvaru, uninhabited island.
And were you the only, resident?
There were four others, and they were sent there by the New Zealand government to keep an eye on the war activities, you know, Japanese, maybe submarine, whatever it is. And so they were on that island and on other islands as well.
Yeah. Your father ended up lashing you to trees, all the kids, right?
Yeah.
Tying you up there?
Well, before that, preparing for the hurricane, he... tied ropes around our waist, and there was plenty left here to put around the coconut tree. Okay, and then when the seas rise, it takes us up, loosen when it comes down, brings us down. That was the plan, and then before nighttime, before dark, the wind was just, you know, just wild. He noticed that the coconut trees were being uprooted or broken, you know, broken in half. And so he said, oh, that's not going to work. So...
you can laugh now.
That plan was... Okay, so now when the big wave hit the house we were, the thatched roof house we were in, it was nighttime, but it was light because of the lightning. It was just constant, so there was light. We left the house and crawled. You couldn't stand up. You crawl and just cling to the gravel and the sand, whatever you can, towards the three trees that were still standing.
What kind of trees?
Tamanu trees. So he just tied us to the branches. Yeah, to the branches up.
How many kids did he tie?
Four.
And then tied himself?
No. He just hung on. Yeah. It just hung on to a branch when the wind was powerful.
Wasn't the sea level up over the sand? I mean, basically the island got covered,
didn't
it?
We climbed up to the top. Yeah, the top where the branches take off like this. And he had his hut right on top of those branches. But, he got into it. Mm.
And I know in your book you say that three-quarters of the landmass of the atoll was washed away.
Yeah, it was cut. Here's the island here, and ended up with two channels. The island was just split, you know, by the sea.
And what happened to the other observers who are on the island?
Well, my father said they could, of course, come up to his house, to his hut up at the top, and it saved them, too, because they were... two of them were... Europeans, New Zealanders, and this was kind of very different for them, very, very different. And it just shook the whole time. It was cold, and we were frightened. They were totally helpless. But the two boys from Manihiki were okay. You know, they were fine from another atoll, which is called Manihiki.
Well, how were you doing? You were a little kid.
Yeah, we're fine.
How crazy was it? You were being buffeted by winds. The water level was coming up.
Well, like I said, there was some excitement to it. I hope it doesn't reach us, you know, and hang on and pray. Because my grandmother always says, always pray, you know, so pray. It was okay. I don't remember being totally overpowered by fear. I don't remember. It was exciting, and it was a matter of survival, you know, thinking about, looking at, okay, this happens here, that branch. There's another branch there. I do that to this day. When I drive to Punalu, I'm looking at all the trees in case a tidal wave, you know. And with my grandchildren, I said, no, that's not going good because they can't climb up that one. They're no, you know, it's got to be where there are branches so we can get up. So I do the same thing.
Plan B, right?
Yeah. And so there you have to keep an eye on what next, you know, what next, yeah.
And at some point, the waters subsided, the winds yeah. stopped, and
yeah.
what?
Yeah.
You're on a decimated island.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we ate the, you know, there's plenty of fish and turtles and sharks in the middle of the island where the waves came from the ocean, from the lagoon, meet in the middle. They bring all these beautiful fish, this lovely stuff, and we were able to eat, live on that for 2 days only, and then they began to decompose. Yeah, and then the flies, millions of flies eating all these dead fish here. Yeah.
What did you do after that?
We ate birds, yeah. The birds returned out of the hurricane. The birds had disappeared somewhere else. And after the hurricane, you could hear them at night. We heard them one night all cry, making their noise as they're coming back to Suvaru. So we ate lots of birds. And then we made spears out of ngangye wood, made spears, and we go on the reef and spear grouper, yeah, other fishes, yeah.
Amidst many personal hardships, Johnny Frisbee's father, Robert Dean Frisbee, continued to write travel stories, news articles, and 6 published books about island life in Polynesia.
He wrote, his first book was called The Book of Puka Puka, and it's a classic, yeah. And then there's Amaru. It's a first novel. That's the first novel he wrote. And I typed it. That's how I learned to type. When he gave it to me, he would at night write by hand in the light of a lantern, and then he would give me the script in the morning, and then I type it on his little Remington. Like this.
So not surprising you would turn out to be the writer because you've been doing diaries.
I know.
You know.
Yeah. And then when his last book, Dawn Sails North, he did the same thing. We were on Rarotonga then. So he decided enough of this. So he sent for a book, an instruction book on how to type with all the fingers. So I taught myself how to do that and typed Dawn Sails North. That was his last book. Was published after his death there. Yeah.
Johnny Frisbee, encouraged by her father's love of storytelling and literature, wrote Miss Ulysses from Puka Puka. Audiences in the Western world started to read about her South Sea adventures in 1948.
You wrote this book between the ages of 12 and 14.
I kept it, started the diary at 12, yeah. And, no, I finished the book at 15, yeah. Came out when I, just before my... just around 16, when I was 16, just before my father died.
So it was a diary. In which language did you keep your diary?
I kept it in Puka Puka mainly, and then English. As I went along, I write in Puka Puka, and I would ask my father what that word is in English, and he would explain it to me, and then I would use the word. But I was beginning to, by the time I was 14, I was able to write in English. Might be not the best, you know, but I was able to use adjectives because my father said you can't just write like that. You have to put a colorful word there to, you know, to make the next word happy.
And Miss Ulysses, where did Miss Ulysses come from?
Well, because there were no children's books in that part of the world growing up, my father used, at nighttime, used it rather than read, and there's no children's stories, he would tell us the story of Ulysses in the Iliad and the Odyssey of Homer. You know, every night he would go through the whole a series of adventures of Ulysses, and that's where that was all I knew, you know. And so when the book was finished and my father said, well, we've got to find a name for this book, we thought about it for days and days, and then I said, oh, you know, how about Miss Ulysses? because I'm Ulysses, aren't I, Daddy or Papa? You know.
You identified with Ulysses, and there was an adventuring of life. You were facing elements.
That's right. And we traveled a lot, you know, we did.
Johnny Frisbee's father, Robert Dean Frisbee, contracted the same illness that took his wife. He was diagnosed with tuberculosis in 1943. Despite his declining health, he continued to travel the South Pacific and write. In 1948, Robert Dean Frisbee died at age 52, orphaning Johnny and her siblings.
Did your dad pass away in...
We were on Rarotonga.
Rarotonga.
The big island of Rarotonga. Mm-hmm. And he's buried there. Mm-hmm.
And you became an orphan.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's three of us. He had sent my two brothers to New Zealand just before he passed away.
Someone who's lost their parents as a child would have devastating feelings of loss. Mm.
My father, yes, with my father, because I relied so much on him for an extension of my Polynesian Pukapukan. You know, it was just natural because he understood my Polynesianness, you know. And my eagerness to be like him, you know, he understood that, and I missed that. I didn't know where to turn.
And then who decided what would happen to the children?
I did, yeah. Peter and Barbara Engel from Lanikai had read my father's books, and so they sailed on a yacht, Lofa, through some of the Pacific Island to find him because they were told that he was in that part of the world. So when they finally got to Tahiti, they looked up James Michener, who informed them that my father was on Rarotonga, living in Rarotonga. So they sailed to Rarotonga, and we met. And by that time, my father had an idea. He has an inkling he wasn't going to live long. So he asked the Engels if they would take me with them, make sure that I get an education, okay? And they promised. So when he passed away, Barbara Engel wrote to me to say they were in New Zealand. As soon as they arrived in Hawaii, they will send for me. And that happened in April 23rd, 1950. I landed at the Yole Airport in Honolulu, lived with them. And immediately I started looking for families for my two sisters. The Engels happened to be very, very good friends with the Dawsons of Kailua. And they had three sons, and I used to play with them all the time. And I thought, no sister. Okay. So I approached Suma and Lee Dawson and asked if they would like a sister for their sons. And they say, yes, absolutely. Boop. About 6 months later, my younger sister was here. And while I was at camp, as a counselor at Kokokahi Camp, a year later, the Fenders, my and Pa Fender, who managed the camp, where the YWCA is now, that was Kokokahi Camp, that was in 51, and we got to know each other, and I thought, oh, okay, they're very nice people. And so I asked if they would take my sister Elaine. And they said, yes, absolutely.
Just amazing. And never having met them, but knowing you. And you functioned as the oldest child. Your brother had been given away.
So they arrived at... And we lived happily ever after, and it was so nice because every weekend we would be together.
Johnny Frisbee and her two sisters were reunited on Oahu in 1952. The Frisbee daughters spent the remainder of their teenage years in Hawaii, raised separately in different families. Much like her adventurous father, Johnny did not stay planted in Hawaii for very long, and after graduating from Punahou School in Honolulu, the travels of Miss Ulysses began again. At the time of our conversation in early 2017, she was nearly 85 years old and getting ready for more Pacific travels.
Mahalo to Florence Johnny Frisbee of Honolulu, who as a teen was credited as the first published female author from Polynesia, for sharing your story with us. And thank you for joining us. For PBS Hawaii and Long Story Short, I'm Leslie Wilcox. Aloha a hui ho.
For audio and written transcripts of all episodes of Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox, visit pbshawaii.org. To download free podcasts of Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox, go to the Apple iTunes Store or visit pbshawaii.org.
Your first name is actually Florence, but everyone knows you as Johnny. Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
It happened when my mother, in Tahiti, and my mother was in labor, and my father and all his friends, Andy Thompson, James Romanhall, Nordoff, all his friends, sailor friends, they were all drinking Johnny Walker whiskey. One of the friends said, "Girl or boy, it's going to be Johnny, you know."